Welcome to today's edition of the Rush Limbaugh Show podcast.
Hello, everyone. I know that I am most certainly not the Limbaugh that you tuned in to listen to today. I, like you, very much wish Rush was behind this golden microphone right now, welcoming you to another exceptional 3 hours of broadcasting. For over 32 years, Rush has cherished you, his loyal audience, and always look forward to every single show. It is with profound sadness I must share with you directly that our beloved Rush, my wonderful husband, passed away this morning due to complications from lung cancer. As so many of you know, losing a loved one is terribly difficult. Even more so when that loved one is larger than life. Rush will forever be the greatest of all time. Rush was an extraordinary man, a gentle giant, brilliant, quick-witted, genuinely kind, extremely generous, passionate, courageous, and the hardest working person I know. Despite being one of the most recognized, powerful people in the world, Rush never let the success change his core or beliefs. He was polite and respectful to everyone he met. Even most recently, when he was not feeling well in the hospital, he was so appreciative to every single doctor and nurse and custodian and first responder. He never wanted to put anyone out and always thanked them profusely for their help. From today on, there will be a tremendous void in our lives and, of course, on the radio. Rush loved our miraculous country beyond measure. An unwavering patriot. He loved our United States military, our flag, our Constitution, our founding fathers. He proudly fought and defended conservative values in a way that no one else can. Rush often stood up and took arrows on his own because he knew it was the right thing to do. Rush encouraged so many of us to think for ourselves, to learn, and to lead. He often said it did not matter where you started or what you look like. As Americans, we all have endless opportunities like nowhere else in the world. Rush gave us hope that through hard work and determination, we can overcome the obstacles in our lives and be our best. Many of you started small businesses or pursued personal dreams because Rush gave you the faith that you could. He made the most complex issues simple to understand, while making that level of genius look easy. It most certainly was anything but easy. Irreplaceable, remarkable talent. On behalf of the Limbaugh family, I would personally like to thank each and every one of you who prayed for Rush and inspired him to keep going. You rallied around Rush and lifted him up when he needed you the most. I am certain, without a shadow of a doubt, if he could be here today, he would be. He loved you, and he loved this radio program with every part of his being. Instead, we know our Rush is in heaven, encouraging us in the same way he always did on earth. Rush's love for our country and belief that our best days are ahead live on eternally. In Rush's honor, may we all continue Rush's mission in our individual lives and communities. I know all of you listening are terribly sad. We all are. I'm terribly sorry to have to deliver this news to you. God bless you, Rush, and God bless our country.
The day is going to come, folks, where I'm not going to be able to do this. I don't know when that is. I want to be able to do it for as long as I want to do it. But the day will come where I'm not going to be able to. And I want you to understand that even when the day comes, I'd like to be here. If I have this sense of needing to constantly show my appreciation for all that you have done and meant to me.
Remember when Rush said that back in December of 2020? He said that this day would come. He told all of us that. The day where he'd want to be here with us, but he wouldn't be able to because of his health. But I know he'd want to be here. For all of us. And if he can't be here today, let's be here for him.
And we are back, America's anchorman, America's truth detector. The views expressed on this program documented to be almost always right, 99.6% of the time. That's the latest opinion audit in from the Sullivan Group. And you are part of the fastest 3 hours in media. Rush Limbaugh having more fun than a human being should be allowed to have. Nation's leading radio talk show, the most eagerly anticipated program in America, program which meets and surpasses all audience expectations on a daily basis. I am your host for life, not retiring until every American agrees with me.
And if he can't be here today, let's be here for him. This program's for you, Rush. From all of us.
Well, Rush, you keep talking about Reagan. And all of that. But, you know, Reagan, the era of Reagan's over so long ago or whatever. You know, the question is, how did Reagan overcome the media? The media hated Reagan as much as they hate Bush. The media hated Reagan as much as they've hated Nixon. The media hated Reagan as much as anybody has ever hated the Republicans. Don't doubt me. For those of you that weren't alive, do not doubt me. Reagan was hated and despised. The players were different. Their names are Sam Donaldson and Dan Blather and so forth. He was just as despised as any media hated Bush or Nixon. And yet you've heard that, yeah, well, but Reagan, he had this charisma. He was able to speak directly to the American people. He was able to go over the heads of the media and speak to the people unfiltered. True, but that's not why Reagan succeeded. It all comes down to the same thing, substance and reality versus spin, PR, buzz, and myth. The end result. Look at what happened when Reagan was president. The economy grew like gangbusters. I don't care what the media is saying. The reality was the economy was great. We were vanquishing communist foes, foreign policy. I mean, the point here is the way you overcome the media is with success on the ground. But you don't vie for a buzz success or a PR success. You don't try to have success that's defined by persuading as many people as possible you're successful. You define success by being successful, implementing policies that work. that really benefited people because they helped themselves. The reason Reagan was able to overcome the media is because his policies revived a country which was in as bad a shape in the latter 70s as it is now, which is precisely what we need again. We don't need PR tactics to try to convince the media we're not mean or bad. We don't need tactics to get the media fooled. We just need somebody who is unabashedly and unafraidly conservative, who will implement policies that will work and will bring actual positive results to people's lives. And then it doesn't matter what the media says. They'll look like buffoons, like they did in the 80s. It's just, it's substance over symbolism, reality over buzz. That's all it is. Back after this. But my dream would be if everybody in this audience, or if everybody who would just listen to me two times, would get it about liberalism. That's the great threat that we face. The great challenge of our time is liberalism or socialism, communism, which now all find their home in the Democrat Party. They must lose and lose elections. They must continue to lose elections. They must never become the majority in this country. They must never become the majority of thinking. They've always been around. They always will be. But they need to be defeated politically, annihilated politically on an ongoing, consistent basis. It's a tough chore. Most people don't see other people ideologically. Most people don't see other people politically. Note that's how the left is trying to accomplish it, though. Identity politics, they're trying to get people who are wavering and don't really care about all this stuff to hate us on the basis of race or on the basis of gender or what have you. They steer away from ideas. They can't win debates on ideas. So they cloak and camouflage their objectives in other things like compassion and happiness, freedom, whatever else, when they stand for the exact opposite of these things. So that's why I spend time talking about this. It's just an ongoing effort to educate people what I think is the greatest threat that we face. Now, consequently, they think the same thing. They think the greatest threat that we face is us. And they're right, because we are standing directly in the way of their amassing all of this power that they want. We do not want power over them. We just want them to lose. We just want them to remain a minority. I don't care if they're happy or unhappy. The problem is we love everybody. We want everybody to appreciate living in this country. We want everybody to be able to access the wonderful opportunities this country provides everybody. Intellectually, I don't understand liberalism. And there's no way anybody can, because it isn't an intellectual application. It's not about thinking. Liberalism is totally about feeling. And ironically, that's one of the reasons why it continues to seduce people. The emotions have much deeper impressions, make much deeper impressions, and they're much longer lasting than words that people hear. And that's a tough thing for me to admit, because I'm in the word business. You know, I don't come here dripping emotions all the time. But it is true. People don't remember what you say, but they'll never forget how you make them feel. So if in this case, if Trump is making people feel confident, if Trump makes people feel happy, if Trump makes people feel involved, engaged, if Trump makes people feel like that the country has a chance with him, the hell with what he's saying. It won't matter. While all the critics of Trump, can you believe what he's saying? Do you believe what he said about Bush? How could his supporters, my God, Rush, how could his supporters, how can you excuse what Trump's saying? Nobody's hearing what Trump's saying. Isn't it evident by now? Whatever he's saying doesn't matter. It's not costing him any support. It's all about how he's making people feel. And I would submit to you it's the same thing with Obama. And by the same token, if you have your average wet noodle Republican could be, who knows, brilliant, smart, whatever, if there's no charisma personality there. I don't have anybody in mind. I'm just using this as a exercise. The emotional component of politics, one of the most frustrating aspects of it to me, because I don't know how you battle it. I don't know how you talk people out of their emotion. I don't know how you talk people out of the fact that something or somebody makes them feel good.
This is the Limbaugh Legacy. Some people are great examples of conservative ideas.
Part of my job is to notice things before you do and then tell you. It's called a cutting edge. I'm on it. I own it. There's a little game being played by the established Republican commentariat, the what I call the inside the Beltway conservative intelligentsia, or the Republican intellectual elite. And it is aimed at muddling conservatism and discrediting, taking down, if you will, conservative Tea Party candidates in the Republican presidential primary process. And it is the way to do it, by the way, is a page right out of the Democrat left's playbook. Now, last week, I mentioned and discussed at some length the argument that some were making that if conservatives demand candidates who are too pure, they can't win. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's effervescing out there. And it always does. We can't win, you know, with a conservative that's too pure, that's too rock-ribbed, it's too rigid. We need a conservative who understands that raising taxes now and then is a reasonable and sometimes intelligent thing to do. We don't want the kind of purity that says never raise taxes. We don't want the kind of purity that gives us the social issues. We need Republicans who aren't as pure, who will realize that sometimes you just have to stop talking about guns and abortion for the larger good of public policy. Well, today in the Daily Caller, there's a guy named Matt Lewis, and it's a takedown of Michelle Bachmann in the Daily Caller. In this case, it's not because she's too pure. In her case, it's because she is too impure. In other words, let's not support candidates who are unabashedly conservative because they can't win. That's the advice. Michelle can't win because she's too unabashedly conservative. Palin can't win because she's too unabashedly conservative. On the other hand, there are no unabashedly conservative candidates in the field. When you get right down to it, this is what happens when you try to analyze politics and write about it, when you don't really understand conservatism and the Tea Party movement, and instead you get swept up in the Washington way and the mentality of gotcha. See, this whole notion of purity, the assault on purity, is just another way of attacking mainstream conservatives. But conservatism, I would say, speaking for myself, conservatism is not about purity. It's about a philosophy. People get sidetracked, purity and all these other aspects. But conservatism is a philosophy. And all conservatives do not agree on all things when it comes to every issue or policy. However, there are fundamental and defining principles and views on life that do define and unite conservatives. Now, let's look at Bachmann. Just a quick peek here at Michelle Bachmann. She is a favored target of establishment Washington. Now, that doesn't come as a surprise to you, does it? I mean, you know that she's a target. You've seen it. It might perplex you as to why. At this stage of the game, look, I know we're in the Republican primaries, and the battle is between ourselves now. It's understandable. But establishment Washington, Bachmann is a favorite target, and even to the point of talking about how, well, she's too short, or she's radical, or what have you. This is an attempt to alert the Tea Party that Michelle Bachmann's a fraud, that she's really not one of you. She's out there trying to create support, command support from all you Tea Party people, but she's not one of you. She's not pure. She's voted for earmarks and ethanol. Okay, well, what else? Michelle Bachmann has been a leading advocate for stripping $105 billion from Obamacare so that it cannot be implemented. Michelle Bachmann was one of the early conservative leaders trying to make sure that Obamacare was defunded. She heard the Tea Party. She heard everybody was taking it very seriously. We must not allow this thing to become law, or we must repeal it or defund it. Okay, here's $105 billion put in there, stealth way by Pelosi. She identified it. She wanted to strip it out of there. She's a leading opponent of the continuing resolution theory of funding government. She steadfastly stood up and opposed the House leadership on funding the government 2 weeks at a time. She's a solid conservative on national security and defense. She's a leading activist for the Tea Party, and she's a major speaker at numerous Tea Party events. Now, all of that distinguishes her quite a lot from most of the candidates who are seeking the Republican nomination for president or planning to. However, because she supported some earmarks in ethanol, she is said now by non-conservatives not to be pure enough for conservatives who are demanding purity. And in another piece, they'll say demanding purity is a bad thing. But right now, she's not pure enough. Nobody can be everything to everybody. On the big stuff, Michelle Bachmann has flying colors when it comes to being defined as a conservative. It's a stretch. It would be an incredible stretch to try to say that she's not a conservative. I think we've talked about earmarks, ethanol, those two things are considering everything else we face, that's chump change. But if you want to focus on those two things, trying to say she's impure, that's what's doing now. That's what's underway. People on our side.
And some people, well, they're not such great examples. Rush explains.
Mitt Romney represents the never Trump mentality that's in the Republican Party. He's a strain of it. He may not be as virulent as some of the pseudo so-called intellectual magazine types who comprise the never Trumpers, column writers and so forth. But he, exactly as I stated, here's Mitt Romney. He's running for president, 2012, and in the early stages of it, there's a rap going around that he's not really a conservative, that he's a rhino, that he's a moderate Republican, and he has to pretend to be a conservative because he really isn't one. And he kind of, like most people in Washington, looks down his nose at conservatives. So in an attempt to persuade people that they were wrong, that he was in fact a conservative, do you remember how he described himself? He said, "I am a severe conservative." And all of us conservatives looked around and said, what the hell is a severe conservative? We've never heard that. Romney exemplifies the Washington establishment. He is career politics. His family, his father, he's career. There is a certain way that those people behave. There's a certain station that they think they've achieved, and they maintain it by knowing their place. And Republicans' place is always second tier. You must acknowledge your second tier. You must acknowledge the superiority of the primacy of the Washington establishment. You must always make it clear that you appreciate being in that establishment. You don't fight back. You don't really try to win in a permanent basis. Yeah, you can test for the presidency every 4 years, and you may win now and then. But then you acknowledge you're going to be destroyed the next 4 years. You acknowledge that you're going to be hit. And that's the price that you will pay for winning. And you have to smile and grin and bear it. And it has grown to just so frustrate Republican voters and conservative voters who have thought all along that the Republicans are actually in this to win and to dominate and to push the other side aside, that we are there to exercise our will over the forces of opposition. We are there to win. That's not the way Republican establishment people look at their role in the establishment. Trump comes along and he just totally upsets the established norms. And it's on that basis he's got to go. And in a claim that he's incompetent and a boob and doesn't know what he's doing, is filled with chaos, endangering the United States, losing our respect around the world. We can't have this. We've established this world order that the United States set up after World War II. Trump's coming along trying to blow it up, and we can't allow this to happen. So it's easily understandable if you know who the players are and if you have come to grips with the way Republicans in this establishment acknowledge their place in it.
Keep it right here. More of the Limbaugh Legacy is coming up next on the EIB Network. Returning now to the Rush Limbaugh Show. More of Rush's words of wisdom to remember.
I have multiple years' experience watching these people. I know liberalism, and I know media like the back of my hand. I've studied them. My entire 30 years of this program, much of it has been spent explaining liberalism to people so that I can effectively refute it. Explaining the media, who they are, how they operate, examples of how they operate, so that I can refute it, so that I can hopefully be persuasive with people in convincing them not to believe out of the chute everything they hear. So with me, when I say it's intelligence guided by experience, it's really it. All I needed to know, based on 30 years of watching this stuff, Troy, it was Brian Ross, and that's 80% of it. The other 20% of it was ABC. And you couple that with what I already explained, they live and breathe with this unquenchable desire to destroy Donald Trump. They wake up every day, each one of them, every drive-by media, male and female, that you watch or read, I'm telling you, every one of them wakes up every day hoping that day is going to be the day that they or one of their colleagues find the silver bullet that's going to nail Trump. They are convinced it's there. They have become delusional. They have so immersed themselves in this lie for the last 12 months plus that they believe Trump colluded. They believe Hillary should have won. They believe the election was hacked and tampered with. They believe Trump colluded with Putin to screw Hillary out of the election. They believe it like you believe whatever you mostly believe in your life. They believe it. They don't hope it. They don't think it. They believe it. And so when here comes a story that features something we have never heard in all of this, never did we hear that Trump as a candidate, not that word specifically was not mentioned. But the bottom line, Troy, is that I know it didn't happen. And the way I know it didn't happen is by watching the very drive-by media and the Democrat Party. If there was evidence that it happened, we would have long ago known it, and they would have long ago used it and long ago tried to get rid of Trump. There is no evidence. There will not be any evidence because there isn't any. They had to manufacture a fake dossier to further along this fake narrative. They are living a series of lies. So it's only common sense that when you have Flynn flipping and admitting to lying to the FBI, these people think that Flynn has told Mueller that Trump told him to call the Russians and fake the election. Screw with the old. That's what they think. Since there's no evidence for it, they have to get as close to that as they can, and that's what Brian Ross's report was. And I had no doubt from the first moment I saw it that it was not going to hold up. Was I guessing? Yeah, because, I mean, I don't work at ABC. I don't know Brian Ross. I hadn't talked to him about it. So, yes, total wild guess, but it really wasn't. It's intelligence guided by experience and a fearlessness to say so, because I know them. I've studied them my whole life. The fact that I've done that, I can't tell you how frustrating it is that more people don't see it, because to me it's so obvious and easy. But again, I've spent 30 years on it.
More of the Limbaugh Legacy coming up on the EIB Network. Rush has been an inspiration to millions, and his callers tell their stories.
Here's Marie in Dayton, Ohio. Glad you waited, and welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm praying for you. Hope you get better. And this is I'm a first-time caller, and I just wanted to say that I am not a victim. I am a minority. I don't believe in victimhood, but racism does exist, and it comes from the Democratic Party. A lot of people miss this. Elizabeth Warren said during the debate that she said that we need to pay people more so we can pay the black and brown people who do this work, when she was referring to child care work.
Right.
And what that tells me is that she believes that black and brown people are the ones that do that work, when there's white people that do honorable and good work of childcare, but brown and black people are also entrepreneurs. And it's our persistence and our perseverance and our belief in the strong work ethic and our belief in the American dream that helps us overcome and become business owners. And I myself, I mean, I was fired from my company, and I bought the company that fired me 2 years later. But it wasn't because...
Wait just a minute. You know, you just can't flash that by us. You were fired by a company, and you bought it 2 years later. How did you do that?
Well, it was a fluke. I never thought I'd be CEO of the company. I was selling medical diagnostic equipment to diagnose dizziness, concussion, and traumatic brain injuries. And I was fired because they said, ironically, they said, I'm making too much money because I'm not educated, I'm not a doctor, and doctors should be selling to doctors. I shouldn't be making that kind of money. I was straight commission, and so they fired me. And at that time, I was a single mom with four kids, minority, but I didn't say I'm a victim or it's a crime from the white man. No, I went out and I worked, and I worked my butt off. And then I started another company, and I earned enough money that when they found out how well I was doing, they called and they said, hey, are you interested in investing? And I said, interested in investing? Well, let me take a look at the book.
So your point is, you're a minority business owner. You have actually... Yeah, you've actually purchased a company and fired you. But you still think, the Democrats still think that you're too stupid to do anything but menial work.
Exactly. And that's what they say. If you listen to the debate and you listen to everything they say, they think you're too stupid. You need the government to help you.
Because they pander to you. That's exactly. You said it. She said it. She's a minority businesswoman. She said it. That's exactly how the Democrat Party looks at minorities as incapable. You know what the biggest problem is? The soft bigotry of low expectations. And that's what the Democrat Party and the American left does to minorities. One of the worst things, if you're a parent and you have kids, one of the worst things you can do is have low expectations of them and tell them that. If you expect great things from them, that's motivating. And it can become self-fulfilling. But if you have low expectations, and it's exact, the Democrats are built on that philosophy, the soft bigotry of low expectation. You can't do much. You can't do it on your own. You can't do it without us. But it's not just minorities that the Democrats treat that way. It's a whole lot of their voter base. It's how they look. That's the preferred constituency.
The day is going to come, folks, where I'm not going to be able to do this. I don't know when that is. I want to be able to do it for as long as I want to do it. But the day will come where I'm not going to be able to. And I want you to understand that even when the day comes, I'd like to be here. Because I have this sense of needing to constantly show my appreciation for all that you have done and meant to me.
Remember when Rush said that back in December of 2020? He said that this day would come. He told all of us that. The day where he'd want to be here with us, but he wouldn't be able to because of his health. But I know he'd want to be here. For all of us. And if he can't be here today, let's be here for him.
And we are back, America's anchorman, America's truth detector. The views expressed on this program documented to be almost always right, 99.6% of the time. That's the latest opinion audit in from the Sullivan Group. And you are part of the fastest 3 hours.
All audience expectations on a daily basis. I am your host for life, not retiring until every American agrees with me.
And if he can't be here today, let's be here for him. This program's for you, Rush. From all of us.
Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the one and only EIB Network and the Rush Limbaugh program on the 1st of August, 2018. This is our 30th anniversary of this program, and I have to tell you, I have been so conflicted all day about how to deal with this. My heart rate monitor on my watch, my heart rate's been elevated about 10 to 15 beats above normal. 10 to 15 beats above normal because of the all the excitement and everything about this day. I'll tell you what we're going to do here today. We haven't prepared a whole lot of audio clips from years gone by because we've done that on anniversaries and anniversary programs previously. We've got some, and we even have some audio of my days as a disc jockey back in Pittsburgh that I don't think we've aired before. Cookie thinks that we have an exclusive, a little montage of me doing a morning show, I think, back in 1971. But there is a program to do here today with news of the day, and I always like to keep looking forward. But people tell me, you know, 30 years doing anything at a high degree of quality is worth commemorating. And if you don't do it, nobody else will. And you have to do it. And you have to do it for yourself, and you have to do it for the staff. There have been people working with you here for all of these years who have helped you make it possible. And all of that is profoundly true. And I am going to reflect on some aspects of this as the program goes on. But rather than do wall-to-wall one thing, I'm just going to try to mix and match various elements of the program as we combine things that we do here, because that's what the program is. It's improv, and it combines a whole bunch of different elements, seriousness, irreverent humor, political commentary, all with credibility on whatever we tackle and so forth. And, of course, then there is you. I mean, and you, without you being out there, none of us are in here. And so it's ultimately all about you. And I remain blown away every day. We go to the phones, and I get calls from people who tell me how long they've been listening. Since 1988, since 1990, since 1992, 1993. It's a stunning and amazing thing. And it is deeply, deeply gratifying. And I'm going to try during the course of the program to express all the various things that I'm feeling and the expressions of gratitude. But I don't want to try to pack it all in here in the first segment. So we'll just do the program and let it happen, see what happens as it happens, because every day, and I maintain that I'm going to do this program like any other. That's why you're there. And so we'll just do it as it happens, it happens. Now, the big news of the day, aside from this program reaching 30 years, and besides the fact that nobody will ever do this again, I don't want to talk about me. I really do not want to make this about me. The big news of the day today, I think two things. One is the president and his urging of the attorney general to end the Russia probe, to basically tell Mueller to shut it up. Now, what's interesting about this is the president could do this himself, in a sense. I'm not talking about firing Mueller, but he could declassify everything that we still don't know about the origins of this investigation and the details. He still chooses not to do it. And the best guess reason for that is the avoidance of a charge of obstruction of justice. I also think there are other factors that are bleeding into this. Now, remember yesterday we shared with you also a story by Jonathan Turley. He wrote a piece saying we are only one witness away from disaster. Trump is only one witness away from disaster. It's not the Manafort trial or the second Manafort trial. Turley's theory is that Mueller is going after Donald Trump Jr. and the meeting at Trump Tower and everything that might have any ancillary involvement or impact on that. There are, you may have heard, rumors of a second Trump Tower meeting that nobody has officially known of or been informed of to this point. Then we have heard the latest addition to this is that Mueller is not going for collusion and he's not going for obstruction. He's going for conspiracy. In a number of indictments that Mueller has handed down to date, one of the charges has been this very vague conspiracy to defraud the United States. Now, I forget who he first charged with that, and I don't remember the specifics, but I do remember that when it happened, a bunch of really smart legal people I know started scratching their heads and said, what is a conspiracy to defraud the United States? I'm not aware of some I'm not aware of a statute. I'm not aware that there is such a charge. But Mueller has charged people with that. So not collusion, not obstruction, but conspiracy. So if you put the fact that Mueller may be aiming at conspiracy to defraud, because all you know, collusion isn't a crime, but conspiracy is. If you conspire to collude, the collusion is not the crime. Conspiring can be. And so if you look at conspiracy to defraud the United States and somehow try to link that to what Donald Trump Jr. was doing, the theory from Turley is that this is where Mueller is headed, because there isn't anything on the president. There's nothing on collusion. There's really nothing on obstruction. You can't get a president on obstruction for doing his constitutionally authorized and permitted duties. But conspiracy, if you can link Donald Trump Jr. and the Trump Tower meeting and some other things and maybe other members of the Trump family to a very wide, broad-based conspiracy charge, then you could really upset Trump, which has been the objective of this from the beginning. And I think the possibility that all of this might be happening explains why Trump has been on the warpath the past couple of days and why Rudy Giuliani has been on the warpath the past week. I mean, these guys have been flooding the media, and they have been launching salvo after salvo after salvo at Mueller. Trump is proceeding on the fact that this whole thing's a witch hunt, that it's a hoax, that none of it is legitimate. Rudy is just all over the place. And the way to understand what Rudy is doing is stop thinking of him as a lawyer. He is a lawyer, and his relationship with Trump may be that he's been hired as a lawyer, but the work he's doing is not legal. Rudy is doing pit bull representation in the media. And I think some people think that Rudy is winning. The objective here is to raise public doubt about the integrity and the honesty of Mueller and his investigation. We even had news yesterday that Trump and his team are preparing their own report, that Mueller is going to issue a report when this investigation ends, if it ever does. And it's pretty easy to predict some of the ingredients of Mueller's report. If he doesn't have Trump on collusion, and he doesn't, and if he doesn't have any evidence of obstruction, nothing that can stick, but he is going after conspiracy, he can write a report that accuses the president of behavior being lax, inattentive, irresponsible. The president's behavior and conduct opened the door for the Russians to come in and influence our... If he writes a report like that, then the media will pick that up. That report would be submitted to Rosenstein. Rosenstein would decide whether to make it public, send it up to Congress. It would be made public, no doubt. And then the media would get hold of it, and that would become the new narrative. Trump may not have colluded, but he made it possible for the Russians to do what they did. Trump may not have actually obstructed, but because he was so lax and so inexperienced and so outside, so unaware of how official Washington works, that in his meandering ways, he may have opened doors for the Russians to enter our politics and our elections that he wasn't even aware of. Can imagine the impact of a report like that. So, and I have no doubt that the Mueller report will contain evidence, not evidence, suggestions, and there'll be supporting evidence to lend credence to whatever these allegations that are made in the report would happen to be. So Rudy's out there. I think they are conducting a plan here that's designed to blunt whatever Mueller ends up saying, reporting, by challenging Mueller's authenticity, his integrity, his bias. That's why Trump keeps talking about this as a hoax and a witch hunt with 13 Hillary donating investigators and so forth. And that's why Rudy is going scorched earth. And this is what the Clintons did. This is what Bill Clinton and James Carville and Stephanopoulos did with Ken Starr. They turned him into a sex pervert since Starr was investigating Monica Lewinsky, the blue dress, lying under oath, the Paula Jones case, which was about sexual abuse and harassment. They turned Starr into a pervert who was such a sexual pervert that the only reason he was doing this is because he got off reading about all the things Clinton was doing. That's what they tried to characterize Ken Starr as doing. So that, I think, is... I'm not accusing the Trump team of being that perverse. I think their attacks on Mueller are warranted. I mean, we've been told that Mueller is the most honest, the most decent, the man with the highest integrity of anyone we could find in Washington to conduct such an important investigation. Well, maybe within the confines of the swamp, that's what they think. But the Trump team can't allow that to be what the general public thinks. If the report's going to have all of this negative stuff, they've got to do whatever they can here to taint it. And anybody in Trump's position would be doing this, except your average Republican, who would be sitting along, going along, sitting silent, saying we must let the system play out and we must deal with the results as they come because we are Republicans and our logo is a gigantic boot print on our backs. And that's just how Republicans in the past have played this. Now, in a related thing, Trump had a rally in Tampa last night that it was to promote the gubernatorial candidacy of Ron DeSantis, running for governor, Republican side here down in Florida. And the rally last night, let me just share with you a report here from somebody at Politico. Politico's Mark Caputo mocks Trump rally attendees as toothless garbage people. Politico reporter Mark Caputo mocked attendees of Trump's Tampa rally on Tuesday night, referring to them as toothless garbage people. And then after 11 hours, Caputo posted an apology. I need to apologize for tweeting caustic remarks after seeing a reporter berated and abused. Hate begets hate. My comments referred only to those jeering and swearing at the man, not at a broad swath of people. But the fault is mine for causing confusion and feeding anger. Nice try, but the fact of the matter is that even before the rally happens, people inside the Beltway think exactly that of most Trump supporters. Toothless garbage people. Hayseed Hicks. Dumb, ignorant, uneducated, stupid. Easily manipulative or manipulative, easily steered the wrong way. Basically, a bunch of disjointed, angry people who cannot adapt to the transforming of American culture and society. They want to take it back to the days of the 50s when they ran the rule and ruled the roost and they were all in charge. And now those days are gone and they can't deal with it. And it's a good thing they have lost out because they are a bunch of toothless, brain-dead people sitting on the deck out in front of the shack playing the banjo as Burt Reynolds and the boys go rafting by. That's what they think of your average Trump voter. And this guy just happened to let it out. Now, he's claiming that what made him do this was the crowd last night getting all over Jim Acosta. Jim Acosta of CNN, who is a regular provocateur of Trump, crowd last night was shouting, CNN sucks! CNN sucks! And Acosta was telling Wolf Blitzer, Wolf, in case you can't understand what the crowd's saying here, saying CNN sucks. So Acosta was reporting to Wolf what the crowd was saying at CNN sucks. And then Acosta, this is dangerous. This is going to lead to several people maybe getting hurt. And I keep saying, you mean like Steve Scalise and other Republicans who were shot at a baseball practice? I'm not aware of any violence having been perpetrated against any of you. You keep acting like it's imminent and it's going to happen, and you ignore the violence that's already happening to Republicans based on the way you guys in the media are doing your jobs. And by the way, as far as Acosta is concerned, let's stop the phony tears. This guy couldn't get more name recognition or more popularity in his life if it weren't for Donald Trump signaling him out. And I will guarantee you that Acosta secretly and privately loves it. Outside of this, he's a typical CNN no-name. But Trump and his administration have singled him out because Acosta decides to play rude, decides to be a provocateur. He knows Trump is going to hit back, and I maintain that Acosta loves it secretly every time it happens. And then Acosta gets to go out and play like he's actually at war and that there are real bullets being fired, and he's risking his life to go to a Trump rally and report what's going on. What they really can't stand is that Trump still sells out and the people there are still madly in love and totally supportive of Trump. Those rallies, wherever they happen, are real live evidence
of the media failure to distance those people from Donald Trump. They're hoping for half-filled arenas. They're hoping for people showing up who hate Trump being in the majority. They're hoping to have that be the result of their reform. They want to cause that. They're looking at failure each and every Trump rally, and it's driving them batty. Got to take a break. Back after this.
This is the Limbaugh Legacy on the EIB Network. Returning now to the Rush Limbaugh Show. More of Rush's great moments we've all shared.
So I've had a lot of emails from a lot of people in the past couple of days. And one of them I received last night that started me thinking. Now, I love things that make me think. I'll be honest with you. And this one did. Do you know how few people can say that they've had the same ethics, the same conscience, the same core beliefs, the same morality, and the same connectivity with themselves in their 20s, through their 40s, and into the 60s and beyond, into their best years? Do you realize how few people are as consistent and reliable as you are? And no, I don't ever stop to think of anything like that. I don't think it's unusual that things I believed in my heart when I was in my 20s would not survive my getting to my 60s. My core beliefs, who I am, I can totally believe that I wouldn't change in those things. But this person said, you don't know how rare it is. And what inspired her to write this, I think she said, was a caller that appeared on the program yesterday saying basically the same thing. Back in just a moment.
Welcome back to more of Great Moments from Rush Limbaugh. Moments we've all shared together.
There is no way that I could begin to touch on or cover all of what I think are the important things that have enabled this program to thrive, because there's so many different events, there's so many people that have been involved, and starting down the road of trying to remember them, and you start at the beginning, you go chronological order. The minute you forget somebody, you got problems. You can't mention them all. Maybe it's better not to start, but then some of them are so important you have to mention them. So I'm hoping there's enough time left today to do as much of this as I can, because that's what anniversary days are for. I remember Johnny Carson on his last show, for the Tonight Show, made a point of saying this is not a performance show, meaning there were no guests, no monologue, no jokes, no nothing. It was strictly a recap. It had some highlights. It had some heartfelt remembrances from Johnny Carson himself, but he made a point of saying it wasn't a performance. And then that was not an anniversary. It was his last show. This is an anniversary show, and parts of it are a performance show, but parts of it are archival and filled with remembrance. It's what I mean about combining these elements. This is from the Rush to Excellence tour stop in 1989. I hadn't even been in New York a year yet. Maybe 13 months. It could have been a year, but I don't think so. Kept being pulled back to Sacramento because how important it was in making this program possible. So here's the second part. There's 15,000 people in the crowd here. This was what's called Arco Arena then. Just hit it.
This whole experience, not one bit of it is work. Not one bit of it. It is all just more fun than I've ever had in my life. It is absolutely no hardship whatsoever to fly around the country, to see people, to be on the radio or any of that, but especially to come back here. You know, you enjoy my show, and I appreciate that, more than you'll ever know. I don't want to beat this into the ground. I'm sure you've all felt like you weren't going to ever amount to anything, even though you knew you were capable of it. I felt that way. The only difference between you and me is that I'm up here and you're out there. And the only reason I'm up here is because you're out there. Right? It's true. You may enjoy my show, but I'll tell you, you people, especially you people in this town, in this area, you don't know it, so I'm going to tell you. You rejuvenated my life. Because a successful radio person is not a success simply because he does what he does. People have to listen to it, appreciate it, and support it. And everybody in this room has. I mean, for me, 6 years ago, to be mired in loneliness and aimlessly walking through life, and then to come here and have tickets sell out in 2 hours? My friends, that hits me in the heart like nothing you can ever imagine will. I mean, I'll tell you. You have rejuvenated my life, and you have made me something I never even thought I could be. And I have just one thing to say to you, a sincere and heartfelt thank you.
That was in Sacramento. I wish I knew the month. It was 1989. I'd have to look it up on the calendar, Rush Dexter Story. It had to be summertime because it's hot as hell. I mean, hot, 110 degrees in the daytime out there. And as I say, they had the roof open all day. What the hell is going on? I mean, I did this thing in a tux. We were videotaping it. It went off like a dream. Anyway, it's fun to relive these old things, these old moments. That stuff sounds, I remember Sacramento like it was yesterday. It doesn't seem like 30 years ago. Anyway, back to the phones. This is Bob in Coronado, California. I'm glad you waited, sir. You're next, and hello.
Well, congratulations to you, Rush. You richly deserve it, and just always remember that you built it.
I did. In the vein of you didn't build that. I appreciate that, sir. Thank you.
Yes. Rush, what I'd like to discuss very briefly is, as a Trump supporter, there's a big difference in sort of why I might be a hidden Trump supporter in 2018 versus 2016. There's really two reasons. Number one, in 2016, I could wear my red MAGA hat around, and people were amused by it. In 2018, liberal people become violent, and I don't wear it, so I can't say it's happened to me, but I know for a fact. And then the second difference between 2016 and 2018, I could go to dinner with friends in 2016 and, you know, have a few adult beverages and then bring out the fact that I think I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. And that would be amusing to them, even liberals. Almost like it was self-deprecating humor to admit that you were sort of stupid. But now if I did it, people will walk away and never be my friend forever. I mean, it's the difference between 2016 and 2018, because of the negative, the libs' reaction and the press's reaction, it's a totally different thing that's going on. But I think the result's the same. The people are going to stay hidden because you just can't be an outspoken, open Trump supporter. And I'd be curious to what your thoughts are.
Unless you go to a rally where you're surrounded by like-minded people. That's a pretty stark difference that you have described here. You can't wear your Make America Great hat again. You can't have dinner or socialize with people that didn't vote for Trump because they've abandoned you. They don't want any part. What do you chalk that up to? You haven't changed, have you?
No. Russ, I think they're just very entitled. It's that elitism comes
from. But wait, before you knew these people, were they that rude? Were they that angry? Were they this lacking in respect and dignity? I mean, who do these people think they are? Were they this arrogant and condescending before Trump came along?
Russ, I think they're like, it's a common human trait. I don't think many of them had really ever experienced losing. Maybe things were too easy for them, and Trump represented losing. You know, maybe George W. Bush didn't because he was close enough to them, but Trump represented losing. And I would say I've been to two Trump rallies. I 100% agree with what you're saying. Go to a Trump rally. I mean, I wish I could have gone to a Billy Graham rally when I was a kid with my grandparents. But go to a Trump rally. Exhilarating. There's just no description for how uplifting.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. You're sitting out there now. You're chronicling, sharing with us the differences in the way you have to live your life from 2016 to 2018. You've had to take off the cap. You've had to go silent and stand mute about your support for Trump. And you think a lot of people are having to do that. Do you think that people like you in 2016 who were just raring and ready to go vote for Trump are still as motivated? Or are they being dissuaded from it because of the way they're being treated by people, by their friends and others? Is this affecting any of them? Is it making any of them go wobbly?
No, hell no. Russ, I'll tell you, without a doubt, nobody's getting wobbly. With 4.1% GDP growth, that maybe we'll have one more print before the election and might even hit 5. The people aren't stupid. You know, 5 million people got $1,000 or $2,000 raise. People are getting paid more.
Yeah, but the consultants are telling us that doesn't matter, that Trump better stop this immigration talk and go talk about the economy because people aren't realizing how good they've got it.
Yeah, Russ, they're talking to the coastal people. I mean, I live out here amongst them. I totally get it. You know, because of your recommendation, I read Selena Zito's book.
Oh yeah,
the Great Revolt. They don't talk to those people. They'll miss it again. There is absolutely no way, provided people use Trump's enthusiasm and they don't become complacent.
Right now,
the midterms turn out bad.
Let's
no
talk
way.
About the midterms though, because when the president was on here an hour ago. And I asked him about his strategy leading into the midterms, and he said something I thought very interesting. He's not sure. He doesn't know if support for him right now is transferable to every Republican running for re-election in the House and those in the Senate. It's another way of saying he's not sure of his coattails. And I guess I was a little surprised because I would think his coattails would still be relevant. I think everybody voting for Trump knows damn well why, and that he'd better continue to have at least a majority in the House if he has any chance. I think Trump's voters are sophisticated enough to know that if the Democrats win the House, all this ends. They're going to just start oversight, investigation, shut down his agenda. Trump voters had better understand that whatever you think of your local Republican— Trump needs more Republicans in the House than Democrats, or all this is going to come to a screeching halt. But he said he wasn't quite certain how transferable, meaning support for him, is for congressional midterm Republican candidates.
Well, Rush, he said it both ways, that maybe I'll do it before, maybe I'll do it after. I think I hope he was throwing a bone to the soft Republicans that want him to win.
Yeah. I thought the same thing. I thought that there's something going on. He made it a point two or three times talking about how great they are.
But, Rush, what happens if he loses the midterms by 2 votes, there is no wall. I mean, the House has to propose bills that the Senate signs onto.
It's not just that. Maybe. It's not just that there's no wall. There's no agenda. And if the Democrats win the House, it's going to be nothing but committees that you've never heard of investigating this and that about everything Trump's done. An endless parade of witnesses from the administration. You're going to see oversight of the executive branch like you've never seen if the Democrats win. It's not going to be impeachment. It's not going to be that. They're not going to get rid of him that way. They're salivating at being able to shut this all down and humiliate Trump with him in office. And that's why it's crucial that whatever the support for him that exists out there better be, as he says, transferable. Anyway, I'm glad you called, and I really appreciate you putting up with all my questions. It's not what you expected. You did great.
This is the Limbaugh Legacy on the EIB Network. Welcome back to more of Great Moments from Rush Limbaugh, moments we've all shared together. This is the Rush Limbaugh Show.
This is Alicia in Miami. Hi, Alicia. You're next. It's great to have you open line Friday. Hi.
Thank you for having me on your show.
You bet.
You know, the first time I heard your program, I think it was around March 20-something in 2001. I was home. I just had arrived from Madrid. I married in Madrid with an American citizen, and we decided to move to New York. And you were talking about how you were losing your hearing. And actually, you moved me to tears because I'm a journalist, and I was thinking, what is he going to do if he can't hear? How is he going to continue with the show?
I was doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, you continue to do the same thing day in, day out. And I really got addicted. And even when I went back to Spain, I would try to listen to it through the internet. And then fast forward to spring of 2009, I was a correspondent for a newspaper. I was doing translation and I write. And I was having trouble with my carpal tunnel syndrome. So I had surgery. It went really bad, really wrong. It was a medical negligence, and I lost my fingers, all five fingers of my left hand.
No, wait. You lost all five fingers on your left hand? You are a writer?
Yeah. Lucky for me, they just cut the fingers, not the rest of the hand, because in the beginning they said it was going to be below elbow. So I'm lucky, and I'm alive. But, you know, it's a shock. What are you going to do if you write? So there are many things to many people to credit for my recovery, and you're one of them, you know, because you inspired me. You know, it's like our veterans, they come back without two limbs, three limbs, and they keep going, and they keep doing what they do, you know, and it was the same with you. So just so you know, I really look up to you, and I listen to your program every day, and it was really good while I was doing rehab to keep listening to you, because you know that you can be an individual with strength and stamina to keep going and just not be stopped because you lose your fingers.
Oh, I can imagine. When I was losing my hearing, it was obviously scary, but it was also frustrating. It happened rapidly, but in stages. I lost it all in 6 months. It was about 10% a week at one point. And it finally, one day I came in here, and I literally, I called New York, the engineer, get started on setup for that day's program. I couldn't understand what he's saying. I heard him fine. I just, my hearing had deteriorated that I could not make out the words. And so I'm really honored that I could have, you know, been a part in that for you. I know how important it is, and it's now I don't even think about it now, other than when I just got a new one on my right side, then it becomes a focal point and I tell people about it. But now to me it's just normal. How about you? What is your work around?
I'm doing pretty well. I keep translating. I don't do a lot of gigs on journalism because I'm really disappointed at the state of the profession. So I'm doing a lot of copywriting, translating. And I'm doing well. I work at home with my dog, and I enjoy South Florida. And
well, do you use your right hand to write?
No, both hands. The one both without hands. Fingers. I trained myself. In the beginning, I would use Dragon, the voice recognition software, which is very good. But it's not the same when you write with your hands and when you write with your speech.
Well, you know, that's interesting. Interesting you say that, because, you know, I want to send you, I'm going to send you anyway. You have an iPad or an iPad mini?
No, I don't.
I want to send you an iPad mini. You can dictate on it what you're calling a voice recognition. You can dictate to it any app that has a keyboard, email, word processing, you can dictate. Now, in my case, I speak my thoughts much better than I write them, because that's what I've done my whole life. My brain can't keep up with typing on a keyboard. But it can keep up with my mouth, or my mouth can keep up with my brain. So I just, when I write anything or a lot of things, I dictate it and then go back and clean it up later. Because if I write, I can't type because I get focused on making mistakes, correcting them, and losing my train of thought, and I get frustrated. And I've learned now that I can actually dictate my thoughts, speak them with more vocabulary and more creativity than if I just sit down and write.
Thank you so much. That's so nice. I have to tell you something else. I just bought your Russ Revere and the Brave Pilgrims, not for a kid, but for me. And I'm enjoying it.
You bought it for you?
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm a brash reader, and I try to improve my English, you know, every day. And my learning of history of this country, I'm so glad and so grateful to be able to become an American, which will be very soon. So,
oh, God bless you.
This is the Limbaugh Legacy on the EIB Network.
The fastest 3 hours in media just keep churning away, my friends, and we are at the center of it all.
You've kept her and Rush in your thoughts and prayers. Ladies and gentlemen, Catherine Limbaugh.
Hello, everyone. I know that I am most certainly not the Limbaugh that you tuned in to listen to today. I, like you, very much wish Rush was behind this golden microphone right now, welcoming you to another exceptional 3 hours of broadcasting. For over 32 years, Rush has cherished you, his loyal audience, and always look forward to every single show. It is with profound sadness I must share with you directly that our beloved Rush, my wonderful husband, passed away this morning due to complications from lung cancer. As so many of you know, losing a loved one is terribly difficult. Even more so when that loved one is larger than life. Rush will forever be the greatest of all time. Rush was an extraordinary man, a gentle giant, brilliant, quick-witted, genuinely kind, extremely generous, passionate, courageous, and the hardest working person I know. Despite being one of the most recognized, powerful people in the world, Rush never let the success change his core or beliefs. He was polite and respectful to everyone he met. Even most recently, when he was not feeling well in the hospital, he was so appreciative to every single doctor and nurse and custodian and first responder. He never wanted to put anyone out and always thanked them profusely for their help. From today on, there will be a tremendous void in our lives and, of course, on the radio. Rush loved our miraculous country beyond measure. An unwavering patriot. He loved our United States military, our flag, our Constitution, our founding fathers. He proudly fought and defended conservative values in a way that no one else can. Rush often stood up and took arrows on his own because he knew it was the right thing to do. Rush encouraged so many of us to think for ourselves, to learn, and to lead. He often said it did not matter where you started or what you look like. As Americans, we all have endless opportunities like nowhere else in the world. Rush gave us hope that through hard work and determination, we can overcome the obstacles in our lives and be our best. Many of you started small businesses or pursued personal dreams because Rush gave you the faith that you could. He made the most complex issues simple to understand, while making that level of genius look easy. It most certainly was anything but easy. Irreplaceable, remarkable talent. On behalf of the Limbaugh family, I would personally like to thank each and every one of you who prayed for Rush and inspired him to keep going. You rallied around Rush and lifted him up when he needed you the most. I am certain, without a shadow of a doubt, if he could be here today, he would be. He loved you, and he loved this radio program with every part of his being. Instead, we know our Rush is in heaven, encouraging us in the same way he always did on earth. Rush's love for our country and belief that our best days are ahead live on eternally. In Rush's honor, may we all continue Rush's mission in our individual lives and communities. I know all of you listening are terribly sad. We all are. I'm terribly sorry to have to deliver this news to you. God bless you, Rush, and God bless our country.
The day is going to come, folks, where I'm not going to be able to do this. I don't know when that is. I want to be able to do it for as long as I want to do it. But the day will come where I'm not going to be able to. And I want you to understand that even when the day comes, I'd like to be here. If I have this sense of needing to constantly show my appreciation for all that you have done and meant to me.
Remember when Rush said that back in December of 2020? He said that this day would come. He told all of us that. The day where he'd want to be here with us, but he wouldn't be able to because of his health. But I know he'd want to be here for all of us. And if he can't be here today, let's be here for him.
And we are back, America's anchorman, America's truth detector. The views expressed on this program documented to be almost always right, 99.6% of the time. That's the latest opinion audit in from the Sullivan Group.
And you are part of the fastest 3 hours in media. Rush Limbaugh having more fun than a human being should be allowed to have. Nation's leading radio talk show, the most eagerly anticipated program in America, program which meets and surpasses all audience expectations on a daily basis. I am your host for life, not retiring until every American agrees with me.
And if he can't be here today, let's be here for him. This program's for you, Rush. From all of us.
This is the EIB Network.
More of Rush's words and wisdom to remember.
Well, Rush, you keep talking about Reagan and all of that. But, you know, Reagan, the era of Reagan's over so long ago or whatever. You know, the question is, how did Reagan overcome the media? The media hated Reagan as much as they hate Bush. The media hated Reagan as much as they've hated Nixon. The media hated Reagan as much as anybody has ever hated the Republicans. Don't doubt me. For those of you that weren't alive, do not doubt me. Reagan was hated and despised. The players were different. Their names are Sam Donaldson and Dan Blather and so forth. He was just as despised as any media hated Bush or Nixon. And yet you've heard that, yeah, well, but Reagan, he had this charisma. He was able to speak directly to the American people. He was able to go over the heads of the media and speak to the people unfiltered. True, but that's not why Reagan succeeded. It all comes down to the same thing, substance and reality versus spin, PR, buzz and myth. The end result, look at what happened when Reagan was president. The economy grew like gangbusters. I don't care what the media is saying. The reality was the economy was great. We were vanquishing communist foes, foreign policy. I mean, the point here is the way you overcome the media is with success on the ground. But you don't vie for a buzz success or a PR success. You don't try to have success that's defined by persuading as many people as possible you're successful. You define success by being successful, implementing policies that work, that really benefited people because they helped themselves. The reason Reagan was able to overcome the media is because his policies revived a country which was in as bad a shape in the latter 70s as it is now, which is precisely what we need again. We don't need PR tactics to try to convince the media we're not mean or bad. We don't need tactics to get the media fooled. We just need somebody who is unabashedly and unafraidly conservative, who will implement policies that will work and will bring actual positive results to people's lives. And then it doesn't matter what the media says. They'll look like buffoons, like they did in the 80s. It's just, it's substance over symbolism, reality over buzz. That's all it is. Back after this. But my dream would be if everybody in this audience, or if everybody who would just listen to me two times, would get it about liberalism. That's the great threat that we face. The great challenge of our time is liberalism or socialism, communism, which now all find their home in the Democrat Party. They must lose and lose elections. They must continue to lose elections. They must never become the majority in this country. They must never become the majority of thinking. They've always been around. They always will be. But they need to be defeated politically, annihilated politically on an ongoing, consistent basis. It's a tough chore. Most people don't see other people ideologically. Most people don't see other people politically. Note that's how the left is trying to accomplish it, though. Identity politics, they're trying to get people who are wavering and don't really care about all this stuff to hate us on the basis of race or on the basis of gender or what have you. They steer away from ideas. They can't win debates on ideas. So they cloak and camouflage their objectives in other things like compassion and happiness, freedom, whatever else, when they stand for the exact opposite of these things. So that's why I spend time talking about this. It's just an ongoing effort to educate people what I think is the greatest threat that we face. Now, consequently, they think the same thing. They think the greatest threat that we face is us. And they're right, because we are standing directly in the way of their amassing all of this power that they want. We do not want power over them. We just want them to lose. We just want them to remain a minority. I don't care if they're happy or unhappy. The problem is we love everybody. We want everybody to appreciate living in this country. We want everybody to be able to access the wonderful opportunities this country provides everybody. Intellectually, I don't understand liberalism. And there's no way anybody can, because it isn't an intellectual application. It's not about thinking. Liberalism is totally about feeling. And ironically, that's one of the reasons why it continues to seduce people. The emotions have much deeper impressions, make much deeper impressions, and they're much longer lasting than words that people hear. And that's a tough thing for me to admit, because I'm in the word business. You know, I don't come here dripping emotions all the time. But it is true. People don't remember what you say, but they'll never forget how you make them feel. So if in this case, if Trump is making people feel confident, if Trump makes people feel happy, if Trump makes people feel involved, engaged, if Trump makes people feel like that the country has a chance with him, the hell with what he's saying. It won't matter.
while all the critics of Trump, can you believe what he's saying? Do you believe what he said about Bush? How could his supporters, my God, Rush, how could his supporters, how can you excuse what Trump's saying? Nobody's hearing what Trump's saying. Isn't it evident by now? Whatever he's saying doesn't matter. It's not causing him any support, costing him any support. It's all about how he's making people feel. And I would submit to you it's the same thing with Obama. And by the same token, if you have your average wet noodle Republican could be, who knows, brilliant, smart, whatever, if there's no charisma personality there, I don't have anybody in mind. I'm just using this as a exercise. The emotional component of politics, one of the most frustrating aspects of it to me, because I don't know how you battle it. I don't know how you talk people out of their emotion. I don't know how you talk people out of the fact that some...
Returning now to the Rush Limbaugh Show. More of Rush's great moments we've all shared.
And we go back to the phones. We have Ron, Highway Around.
Maha Rushy.
He's in Atlanta. Okay, great. How are you doing, sir?
Doing great. Listener since about 92. Hey, listen, Rush, one of the things that makes your program so outstanding, obviously beside your humble self, is the parodies that you come up with. I mean, nobody does what you do on a regular basis. And I'm curious about the creative process. Where do those come from? Do you think of them and say, hey, Mr. Paul Shanklin, make me a parody about this? Or do people send them to you? How do they happen?
Well, the parodies had kind of an interesting life span. When the program first started, Every song parody and bit was something that I had prepped and stored up and wanted to use for a while. This inspired people to start sending things in. And some of them were usable, and I did, ignorantly. I thought they were genuine contributors, and later I started getting bills and people demanding that I announce who did the parody. So I stopped accepting anything that was submitted. I learned early there was a big trick behind that, not just with parodies, but any number of things. Where we currently are now, we have a satirist, the white comedian Paul Shanklin, who lives in Tennessee, who he basically scripts these. He does the impersonations. He does the voice synthesization to facilitate the impersonations. And it's all a result of what happens on the program. That serves as the inspiration. Sometimes I have an idea to ask him to do it, but he submits. If I like it, use it. If I want some changes, change them. But they're basically spontaneous based on what happens in the news. The parodies, the satires, have taken a fascinating, I stop and think about it, road in the way they happened. There are many phases. This program has gone through many phases. The opening phase, when it was brand new, nothing like it, nothing else out there like it. It was just hot as firecrackers going through the roof. I remember going to Atlanta to a football game and the whole stadium stopping and applauding. Said Bush Stadium in St. Louis, because it was so brand new, it was nothing like it. It was the first national conservative show, and it wasn't just politics. We were making fun of liberals with parodies and all kinds of stuff. It was a... and then it dies down after it becomes more settled in, and the program hopefully never static. It's constantly growing and changing and adapting to all kinds of factors. The host gets older and more mature. The subject matter becomes more serious. Different power players in Washington and in the media determining what's discussed. It could never get stale if you stay hip to it. And so the parodies are the same way. And early on, when it was brand new, you know, success has many fathers, and failure is an orphan. And couple that with robust naivete on my part. So first 2 years, I mean, I've got all kinds of little helpers out there that I don't know. People are sending me their thoughts on things. And most of it was up and up. And some of it, I said, this is really good. And I would share it, sometimes identify it or not. And in some cases, I found out that people sending stuff had their own websites, and I ended up being accused of copying and stealing from their website. It was a setup. There were other times where a spouse, you know, you've used enough of this. Don't you think you should start paying us? This guy said, wait, I'm just trying to be nice, for crying out loud. You're going to the trouble. I'm just trying to be nice. So I eventually said, to hell with it. The inclusiveness is just going to be me, only me, none of this other outside stuff. Being nice doesn't work. And at the parodies were the same way. There were things that were submitted over the transom. One of the most famous parodies here that was not commissioned, per se, was the parody of Dion and the Wanderer, the swimmer with Ted Kennedy. And that was submitted by a couple of guys in Albany. And, it's a great impression. Dion DiMucci, the song, was Ted Kennedy singing it. Yeah, let's hear just a little bit of it here, just to give people a flavor of what we're talking about here. This was submitted over to Transom from Albany. Didn't know the guy. Played it over and over again.
Well, I'm the type of guy who will never settle down. Where pretty girls are, well, you know that I'm around. I kiss them and I love them, cause to me they're all the same. I get so gosh darn hammered, I don't even know their names. Cause I'm a philanderer, yes, a philanderer. I sleep around. Well, my views are on the left, got a bimbo on the right. Only God'll know where I'll be passing out tonight. And if you want to ask me which girl I love the best, I'll tear open my shirt, got Mother Rosie on my chest. Cause I'm a philanderer, yes, a philanderer. I sleep around. Oh yeah, I'm the type of guy, he likes to roam around. I'm never in one place, I roam from town to town. And when I find myself falling for some girl, I hop right in a car of mine, I take her for a whirl. Cause I'm a Kennedy, yes, I'm Ted Kennedy. The car spins round and round and round and round and round.
And they were, every time we play one of these, it would inspire others. And we had a group from California called the Dave Smith Band, and they alerted us to the Klaus Nomi. It was the massive growth era, but the current evolution now is that Paul Shanklin is our official satirist and parody produces them, and he's the white comedian. Lives in, I think, Memphis or Nashville, somewhere in Tennessee. Doesn't matter where he is. And it's all derivative of what happens on the program. So it's a collaborative process, but they're not scripted in advance. A lot of it's, the singers have to be hired and all that, but the more improv it is, the better. And the sooner it gets done after an event happens, the better. Some of these things used to take 3 months or 3 weeks to produce, and by that time, you know, the issue's over and dead and gone with. Born Free. Well, that was just Andy Williams. And I just put a bunch of guns and bombs and explosions over it, Rush the Knife. Rush the Knife. This one, what a history. A FedEx driver or UPS in Las Vegas created Rush the Knife based on Mac the Knife by Bobby Darin. And it was just classic. It still holds up to this day. And we can't play it because it's owned by the estate of whoever it was that owns the Three Penny Opera. And we're under threat of jail if we ever play it again. So on anniversary shows, we've snuck in like 20 seconds of it, fair use, and we've just rolled the dice under the philosophy it's better to apologize and ask for permission. The Rush Hawkins singers and Barbara Chenault Law, that was over the transom, the opera singer from the soloist, soprano from Dallas. The audience got into the program. They were just... The number of people buying billboards for the Dan's Bake Sale, you know, out in Fort Collins, Colorado. Anyway, that's an overview of the
of the parody situation. But his question was about the creativity of it, I think. And it all is inspired by what happens on the program, and creative juices flow from that. I mean, for every parody that you hear, there are probably two or three that are submitted that don't pass muster. We're kind of like Apple in that regard. We don't use it. We're ready to use it if it's right. Sometimes we'll test market something we're not sure of. But. And all of these are on display constantly for people to call the program and are on hold. That's what we do, is play the parodies, you know, rather than elevator music. Muzak put people to sleep.
This is the Limbaugh Legacy on the EIB Network. Returning now to the Rush Limbaugh Show. More of Rush's great moments we've all shared.
I want to go to the phones for a brief moment. I just saw a note. There was a young girl on the phone Friday, during Open Line Friday, that apparently we didn't get to. She's 13. She was on hold for most of the program. Her name is Olivia, San Antonio, Texas. And Olivia, first, I'm sorry you held out for so long Friday, but I'm very gratified that you did. I'm very grateful. And I'm glad you're back here today. We got her number. Her parents graciously allowed us to call her back. So here you are, Olivia. Thank you so much. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Well, I'm great. Great to have you, and it's great to know that you're out there.
I just wanted to say my whole family loves your Rush Revere series. We think that Liberty is our favorite character.
Yeah.
We just love you and Liberty together. It's hilarious. And my family went on a history trip in the fall, and we listened to your books, and then we went and saw the famous site that you talked about in your book.
You did. How long did that take? I mean, did you go to all of them? Did I understand you correctly?
Yes. We went up the East Coast, and it took 7 weeks.
7 weeks? You took a 7-week trip to visit every historical place we wrote about in the Rush Revere books?
Yes.
Holy cow, 7 weeks. Did you do them all back to back, or did you do a week here and then a week there? You just devoted 7 weeks?
We did them all back to back. We drove and drove and drove.
I'm floored. How many in your family?
Five of us went. My grandparents, my sister, my mom, and then me.
Well, what did you think? Okay, so you said you listened to the books. You listened to the audio version, or did you read them too?
I haven't read them. I listened to them.
Okay. Well, that's good, because you got to hear me read them, and that's as good as reading them. You can't do better than that. So, what did you think of all these places? I mean, you heard about them in the books, and then you see them. Were your expectations met? Were you glad you did this?
Yes.
Did you have a favorite place or a most meaningful place?
I think I liked I actually got to stand on the spot where the Boston Massacre took place.
Yeah, Boston. There's so many spots in Boston that we wrote about. That's the old church, the Revere locations. They're just, well, I'm so happy that you did that. I've had some calls from people that went to a couple. They take a week here, a couple weeks there, go to certain places. But you did all, and your family with you. That is, that's just above and beyond. You know, you say your favorite character is Liberty.
Yes, sir.
Well, we have the whole Revere operation. We've got a whole goodie bag full of exciting, really good stuff that somebody like you would love to have if you are that into these books, which is just great. I'm floored that you had the time, your family took the time to do this. We put a lot of time writing these books, and we wanted to get them as historically accurate as possible. You know, we believe, Olivia, that if more people actually knew, if they were taught
the really unique and great aspects of American history, that we wouldn't have as many problems in the country as we have today, because there wouldn't be so many misunderstandings about what kind of country we are and what our founders intended it to be. So I'm so moved to learn that you did this.
We tell everyone about the books that we meet. We tell them all about our history trip, and we tell them about your books.
Well, I can't. That's even better that you're doing that. It's too bad you didn't have a stash of them to give away as you were telling everybody about. Maybe we could do something about that. Look, Olivia, thank you so much. Now, don't hang up, because we need to get a mailing address for you where we can send you the Liberty Revere goodie package and some other surprises in there, because this is really above and beyond the call what you've done here. You've really gotten so into it. The reason we did this, you have epitomized the reason that we did these books.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
I can't thank you enough, Olivia. Thank you so much. Remember, don't hang up. A nice man, Mr. Snerdley, will be with you in mere moments to get your mailing address. Boy, folks, that kind of feedback. 7 weeks to visit all the spots. Their family took her, five of them. That's just... it's amazing. Flat out amazing. Thank you again, Olivia, and Olivia's parents. They're from San Antonio, Texas, and she was on hold. It was open line Friday. She was on hold a long time Friday, and I made the mistake of not getting to her, so she let us call her back.
This is the Limbaugh Legacy on the EIB Network. Welcome back to more of Great Moments from Rush Limbaugh.
This is Dwayne in Boston. Great to have you, sir, on the EIB Network. Hello.
The reason why I called, I've been listening since high school. I'm 54 now. My mom gave me a book of yours in high school, and I was talking about it online the other night after you got your award. I'm African-American Christian, but I'm conservative, so, you know, I'm automatically a pariah in certain circles. But I was talking about how me and my followers need to keep you lifted up in prayer and cover you and your family and your wife and stand with you while you go through, because I believe you come out on the other side victorious. And while I was doing that, a guy started going in on me and my mom. My mom's been dead since 2010, but he said, oh, your mom gave you a Rush book. Did she give you a hallmarks book as well?